Most agree that green energy has a huge role to play in the future. Indeed, even now. But the debate around renewables and their ability to tackle climate change rages on. In the US, President Trump faced mass backlash when he pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Yet recent figures suggest that reductions in carbon emission in the US have been greater than in any other developed country. Here in the UK, government has brought in a range of regulation to tackle the issue of climate change. But often these regulations are responsible for causing more bureaucratic problems than they are for solving environmental problems. Of course, customers bear the brunt of bad policy. Electricity charges for households in England and Wales have risen by 50% in real terms since 2001. When the market moved from being relatively liberal to being significantly more restrictive. So is it time for a rethink of the developed world's approach to renewables? What is the best way to tackle climate change in 2019? Do we need a rollback of regulation, or should we be considering something like a carbon tax? Here to help give some perspective is our guest of the day, Matt Ridley. Matt is best known for his writings on science, the environment, and economics, and has written several fantastically successful science books. He recently gave the IEA's Hayek Lecture on the crucial role of innovation in modern society, and I'm absolutely delighted to have him here today for the IEA podcast. Hi, Matt.
Darren, it's great to be with you, fellow Geordies.
Well, here. Now, Matt, I want to start by asking you about, you know, you've had President Trump facing a sort of torrent of abuse for pulling out of that climate agreement. And actually, we've seen that the US is getting it quite right on carbon emissions. What's happened there?
Well, what's happened is fracking, in a word. Shale gas, actually, to be more accurate, because fracking is actually a 70-year-old technology in some ways. But the development of techniques to get gas out of shale has completely transformed the US energy picture and has done so in a way that has drastically reduced carbon dioxide emissions. Now, Trump shouldn't take very much of the credit for this, because actually it started under Obama. In fact, it started even earlier, started under George W. Bush. But the point is that by replacing coal-fired power with gas-fired power, you hugely reduce the amount of carbon dioxide you produce per unit of energy, because gas is basically one carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms, whereas coal is about one carbon atom for every hydrogen atom, in fact, slightly more carbon atoms per hydrogen atom. Most of your heat is coming from oxidizing hydrogen rather than oxidizing carbon. Now, that's why America has made this extraordinary transition. And it's a great lesson to us, because here in the UK, we did something similar in the 90s. We had what's known as the Dash for Gas, yes, when we replaced a lot of coal-fired power with gas-fired power. And that hugely reduced our emissions. And we then slammed on the brakes. We didn't mean to, but we did. And the reason we slammed on the brakes was partly because we thought gas was going to run out and get more expensive. That turns out to be unbelievably untrue. We now know, because of the shale revolution, that there's an enormous amount of gas in the world. It's going to last for a very, very long time. And the other reason was because we thought we needed to support renewables. Now, the problem with renewables is that they're unreliables. They are intermittent. They only work when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. So as a result, you have to have backup power. And when they are working, they dump what is essentially free electricity onto the grid, free at the point of delivery. It's not free because you had the cost of building the turbines and things. It's actually very expensive. But at that moment, the marginal cost of producing electricity is very low. And as a result, they displace electricity from any other source. And that ruins the economics of building a new gas-fired power station. So nobody wants to do it. So we're stuck with either old, inefficient plants or other plants that can't compete with these renewables. So the problem with renewables is that they have ruined the chances of getting carbon dioxide emissions, because they haven't achieved very much by themselves because of the need for backup power, which is usually less efficient power.
And when you look at the fact that in, I think it was December of last year, Scotland received all of its power, all of the power that Scotland needed from its wind turbines.
The first thing to remember is that electricity is only about 20% of the energy we use. So wind globally is providing a few percent of electricity. In this country, I can't remember what the number now is averaged over a year, but it's a significant percentage of the electricity, but it's not a very significant percentage of the overall energy amount. But the problem is, every time it happens that the wind blows, and Scotland has more wind turbines than England, and it has more wind turbines than it needs on a windy day, but it doesn't have enough on a still day.
Yeah.
So it has to export the electricity to England, which is fine, except there isn't that much in the way of a connector to England. There are some connectors, but there aren't as many as they need on those occasions. They've just put in a new one across the Irish Sea. It cost £1 billion, and it's 4 years late, and it's tripped four times. It's not working. So there's a real problem there. And as a result, what's happening is that Scottish wind farms are being paid double to not send their electricity to England, because the capacity can't cope.
Right.
So they're actually paid more to dump their electricity effectively. And that cost goes to the consumer. Yeah. It goes to the electricity bill payer. My understanding is that the environmental movement has now effectively just become a PR arm of the wind industry. And I don't understand how that happened. Mm. This is a very big, very expensive, very capital-intensive industry run by big capitalists in the City of London. And somehow they've got the Greens to do all their PR for them, where actually they're getting in the way of solving the problem.
Do you think, is wind just good politics?
Well, wind is very poor politics.
Despite all of the wind that they emit, politicians, that is. But,
yes, hot air is politics. Hot air is politics.
Yes.
Well, locally, wind farms are pretty unpopular.
Right.
In my county of Northumberland, there's far too many wind farms, far more than we need.
Yes.
And we had a big groundswell, cross-party opinion in the politicians in Northumberland that this was too much and it should stop. And local people got against wind farms and managed to stop a lot of them.
Right.
And that's true in the whole of England and Wales now has basically stopped building onshore wind farms because they are very unpopular. Now, they're quite popular with people living in distant cities like London who say, oh, yes, I'd like to have a wind farm in Northumberland, but that's a bit unfair on the rest of us. And they're unpopular with a number of environmentalists. I have a lot of environmentalist friends who absolutely hate them. They say they kill birds, they kill bats. In building them, you have to put in the foundations, which go into the soil. They kill hundreds of tons of insects a year, by the way, and we're suddenly supposed to be worried about insect declines, so let's take that into account. They ruin the view for a lot of people. And none of this would matter if they were able to produce really serious quantities of electricity from a relatively small area of land.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't. The density of power is the real problem. This is something people just don't get their minds around. They say things to me like, well, I'd rather have a wind turbine than a nuclear power station. Well, a nuclear power station is roughly 1 million times as effective as a wind turbine in producing, it produces about 1 million times as much electricity.
Mm-hmm.
A gigawatt versus... No, 1,000 times, sorry, I got some numbers wrong there. But it's still, you'd need 1,000 wind turbines to produce as much electricity as a nuclear power station, and that would only happen on windy days. So, and the rest of the time, you've got to have the nuclear power station anyway to back up wind. And if you talk about how to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, there is one source of energy that is completely carbon dioxide free. It's called nuclear. And most environmentalists are dead against it. And it could provide the world with an enormous amount of electricity and energy at the moment. Now, the economics of nuclear are really wrecked by renewables, because what happens is that nuclear has to run all the time. It can't switch on and off. Coal can switch on and off. Gas can switch on and off to some extent. It's not so efficient if it does. But if nuclear has to switch on and off, the economics are completely ruined. And as a result, all over America, nuclear power plants are closing because of the impact of wind energy and solar energy on grids. So, I'm sorry, but if we're really serious about getting emissions down, we're killing the one technology that could do it.
What do you think the role for markets is in this? Because, I mean, how much, I guess the question is, how much do you agree with the statement that markets deal well with environmental problems, and actually it's public funding that has distorted the debate?
I think that's exactly right. We actually, in this country, we deregulated the electricity supply industry in the 1980s, basically. Nigel Lawson took one look at it and said, hang on, this would be better left to the market. And as a result, we ended up with the cheapest and the most reliable grid of any country, as far as I can make out, and certainly of any time in our history. It was remarkable. I mean, an extraordinary change in the cost and the reliability of our grid. Now, that all started to go wrong when we started to interfere and started to pick winner technologies like wind and solar and other things, and started to insist that they have access to the grid. And we did it in a very underhand way. I mean, it started under the Blair government. We said, instead of taxing people to pay for the cost of building a wind farm, because they can't compete in the market with gas, instead of taxing people, we're going to let them charge more to the user. And that hits poor people harder than it hits rich people, because energy bills are a big part of a poor person's budget, bigger part than they are of a rich person's budget. And we've also let them charge industry users, industrial users, more than domestic users. Which means the cost is loaded more onto industrial users, which is fine in the way of protecting domestic users, but of course you pay for that too, because it comes through in the higher cost of goods and services. And one of the, I mean, we keep worrying about what we're going to do if we leave the European Union, and we have Project Fear about that. But where is the concern about the fact that we have the highest industrial user electricity prices in Europe? And this is affecting not just our steel makers and our aluminium smelters, which have all gone now, but it's affecting server farms, it's affecting the internet, it's affecting everything that you and I do, it's affecting the cost of refrigeration in shops, etc. It's making us less competitive. That's the effect of subsidizing wind farms and solar panels.
I mean, going back to that, those stats, which I found pretty shocking, to be honest, that, you know, I guess you are so taken in sometimes, and I personally am so taken in by the media sort of firestorm around Donald Trump, that you assume the US must be this carbon emitting machine. You assume that they are, you know, the dirtiest fossil fuel fired up economy in the world. But actually, the EU has massively increased its emissions. Is the EU just doing a better PR job?
It is a shocking irony that America, which everybody thinks is behaving very badly over climate change, has reduced its emissions by about as much as the EU has increased its emissions in recent years. That's extraordinary when you think about it. And the EU is being pious and preaching at the rest of the world about how it's doing the right thing by signing pieces of paper. Germany's where the problem really lies, because the Germans took one look at the Fukushima disaster and said they wanted to close their nuclear plants, and they hugely subsidized their so-called Energiewende, which is the wind, solar, and biofuel programs. You know, they're growing maize in industrial quantities on the North German plain in a very intensive and unfriendly way, in order to digest it in anaerobic digesters on farms, which then produce electricity from the gas that's produced. When you remember, to grow maize you need a tractor. The tractor runs on fossil fuels, so actually you're not really doing anything. You're just turning fossil fuels into gas and into electricity in a very, very expensive way. So these German policies have been have produced an enormous amount of renewable energy when the wind blows and the sun shines, but not when it doesn't. And in order to back that up, in order to have something that you can rely upon, having closed a lot of their nuclear plants, they've had to build more coal plants. And they're digging new open-cast coal mines all over Germany, etc., to supply this. And that's the reason that emissions have gone up. Whereas in America, coal mines are closing. Donald Trump doesn't want them to. He'd much rather keep them open. But the coal industry is, on the whole, losing out to the gas industry because of the shale gas revolution, which really is by the way, the biggest energy transition we've seen in our lifetimes. It's much more important than anything that's happening in the renewable area.
Does it stand a chance in this country, though? Because if you look at the polling around shale gas, it's quite unpopular, and that is because of this fear that we're going to cause massive tremors.
Yeah, well, what happened was that it began to get a foothold here, the new attempts to do shale gas, particularly in Lancashire, and then there were a couple of tremors and they put a pause on it, and the government said, we're going to stop and get this right, we're going to make sure we get the environmental conditions right, etc. We're going to be very, very much more careful than the Americans and all this kind of thing, and the result of that was that the opposition had time to organise. They discovered that if they sold it right, they could make a lot of money out of opposition to fracking. You know, they could get a lot of donations from people. They became extremely organised on the ground. They got a lot of money off so Ecotricity funds a lot of anti-shale gas campaigning, etc. You know, so a lot of the renewable energy people put money into this, etc. So they've pretty well managed to stop shale gas in its tracks by saying you can't do more than 0.5 on the Richter scale of a tremor. Now, that is undetectable, literally, genuinely undetectable at the surface by human beings. You know, you can't tell if there's a tremor that small. A lorry going past in the street now outside here would be a lot more than that, and that happens all the time. So it's a bonkers rule to have brought in, and it has killed the industry. And that's what the environmentalists knew they were doing, was insist getting these rules through was to try and kill the industry. Now, we may come back to it. We've got an incredibly rich shale gas resource under Northern England, in Lancashire, etc. By the way, I've got no vested interest in shale gas. I have a vested interest in coal, but I'm arguing for coal's main competitor here, so I'm not talking my own interest. Remember, we got a big chemical industry in this country, in Teesside, Scotland, and Deeside in the northwest. Huge chemical industry in this country, built a lot of it around North Sea gas. North Sea gas is running out. Now, that chemical industry is leaving at a rate of knots because it's going to America. It's not going to the Middle East or anywhere. It's going to America, where gas is so cheap. We could be, you know, if we were just tapping this immense resource of gas under our feet, which you can do in a very environmentally friendly way. I mean, you know, once you've drilled the well and fracked it, you then take away most of the machinery and you're left with a thing half the size of this room hidden behind a bush, which produces power for 25 years. When you think about it, energy is absolutely fundamental to the economy. It's not just a sort of nice thing to have, like a car or an iPhone. Energy is the means by which we reverse entropy, in which we create improbable structures like buildings and conferences, and you know, all these things are sort of, you need energy to make order out of disorder. What society is, what wealth is improbable order made with energy. And it's very tough to without a reliable supply of energy. And this is one of the big problems that many parts of Africa have, is they have far less energy available per head to support the kinds of activities that we're quite used to here. I mean, I did a calculation some years ago that a British family of four, if it wanted to generate the energy that it uses in an average day, using slaves on exercise bicycles instead of fossil fuels, right? In other words, going back to roughly how the Romans got their energy, would need 6,000 slaves working 8-hour shifts with no living standards of their own. You know, that's the reality. That's what fossil fuels have done. They've enabled each of us to raise our living standards to an immense degree, and you know, we're 87%, 83 to 87% dependent on fossil fuels, depending on which measure you choose, in the world, which is roughly where we were 20 years ago. We've made no impact. The renewables have come in, but nuclear has gone out to some degree. So we're still hugely dependent on these fossil fuels. Gas is the least carbon-rich one of them. It's also one of the safest and easiest to handle, and we really, you know, that's the one we should be using as much as possible in this century.
I mean, if moves towards decarbonisation are going to continue, do you support things like the climate change levy, the energy company obligation, or the carbon price floor? which actually are hitting the poorest hardest.
Well, that's what I wouldn't do, is have a policy that hits poor people harder than rich people. In the end, some kind of tax on carbon mm-hmm. would deliver the right results.
So you support that?
I've always said that that's the right way to go.
People might be quite surprised by that, Matt, to hear you say that.
I said it in my book, in The Rational Optimist, mm-hmm. 10 years ago. I wouldn't want it as an extra tax. I would want to replace a tax with a carbon tax. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think if you said that we're going to remove all employment taxes, that is to say national insurance in this country, mm-hmm. So we're not going to punish people for employing people, yes. which is what we do.
The jobs tax,
A jobs tax. If we remove all that and we replace it with a tax on carbon, the carbon content of something, the amount of carbon burnt, I mean, carbon itself, nothing wrong with carbon, but when it's oxidized, carbon dioxide, that's the problem. Mm-hmm. Although I think we exaggerate it as a problem, but that's another issue. We mm-hmm. won't get into that. And we'd be totally technology neutral. The point is, we keep trying to pick winners. We keep trying to say, right, we're going to subsidize solar with this amount, renewable certificates.
Yes.
We're going to give solar this much. We're going to give tidal that much. We're going to give wind this much. Instead of, forget all that, just say, look, this is what it costs to make energy with making carbon dioxide. And if the less carbon dioxide you use, the less of that you pay. And that would be the simplest way. And it would have favoured gas and nuclear over the last 20 years. Renewables wouldn't have had a look in. And it certainly wouldn't have sent us down the route of biomass, you know, mm-hmm. burning wood, mm-hmm. which produces more carbon than coal.
Yes.
By the way, some of these technologies benefit me. I mean, as a landowner, wind companies and solar companies are constantly writing to me saying, please, can we give you £1 million to build a wind farm or a solar farm on your land? Maybe not £1 million, but a lot of pounds. I'm turning them down. We've devised a system that takes money from poor people and gives it to rich people. That's what the Sheriff of Nottingham did.
I mean, it's quite a good example, I think, of state intervention distorting the price mechanism.
That's exactly right. I mean, none of this would happen without the state getting involved.
Yes.
The state gets involved because businessmen go along to the state and say, please, can we, here's a brilliant policy, you should mm-hmm. subsidize this. Mm-hmm. And it's crony capitalism. It's big business interests that have influenced the government in this direction. And because they also put money into environmental organizations, they've effectively bought them too. And I think it's rather shaming that, you know, organizations like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, which used to campaign on behalf of the environment, now campaign on behalf of a regressive and rather industrial industry called mm-hmm. the wind industry. Let's not forget, they use plenty of concrete for the bases. They use tons of steel for the wind turbines, and they use lots of rare earth metals for the dynamos in the wind turbines, which are mined in a very dirty way in China. These are polluting industries like any other, and yet they're the darling of the environmental movement. I don't understand it. Or rather, I do.
Quite. I read a really interesting Spectator piece by you on the benefits of global greening. Would you go as far as to say there are some merits of carbon dioxide emissions?
There definitely are. I mean, there's no question there are some. I mean, nobody disagrees with that extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has had some benefits. The big one, as I say, is global greening. Now, what is global greening? It is the increase in the amount of plant vegetation on the planet as a result of the extra carbon dioxide in the air. Now, we knew this was happening, and we know it happens because the carbon dioxide fertilization effect is a well-known phenomenon. If you grow tomatoes in a commercial greenhouse, you actually pump CO2 in to increase the growth rate of your plants. And free air concentration experiments to see if this happens outside in the real world have been done on a huge scale, and they all show the same effect. But what was new was a few years ago, the NASA satellites developed a technique for measuring how much green vegetation there was on the entire planet mm-hmm. as they circled it every few days or whatever it is. It takes them a few hours, probably. And this enabled scientists to come up with a measure of how much green vegetation there was on the planet. And they looked at the data going back 33 years. And the answer is that there's about 15% more green vegetation now than there was 30 years ago. So it's going up at about 0.5% a year. And a huge paper came out in, I think it was 2016 mm-hmm. or 2017 perhaps, saying this, authored by very senior scientists from all around the world, from NASA, from Beijing University and other places. And the lead author, Zaiqin Zhu from Beijing University, said, what we've seen over the last 33 years is the equivalent of adding a continent the size of the mainland United States. Adding two continents the size of the mainland United States over that period of purely green vegetation. This is a lot. Mm-hmm. The effect is strongest. And by the way, they said 70% of the cause of that is the extra carbon dioxide in the air. Some of it is a little more rainfall because a warmer planet has slightly more evaporation from the oceans and things, but most of it comes from just plainly the CO2 effect on its own. And the other, the next paper in the same journal said, oh, and by the way, the more CO2 there is in the air, the more water efficient plants are, the less water they lose. And therefore, this effect is much strongest in arid areas. And it means that as the world gets warmer, plants will be better able to cope with temperature increases. Now, this effect is not just affecting wild habitats like rainforests and grasslands. It's also affecting crops, of course. So there's an enormous beneficial effect on the yield of crops here, which can be measured. It's in the trillions of dollars a year. So now, nobody's saying that there aren't disadvantages too. In the long run, there are disadvantages. Carbon dioxide causes warming, and warming is a problem mm-hmm. because eventually it will lead to difficult problems.
Yeah.
But at the moment, there is no question that the benefits outweigh the disadvantages, that this global greening effect is bigger than any effect on storms or sea level rise or anything like that. Because there is no effect on storms, by the way. Storminess has not changed. The mm-hmm. IPCC keeps saying that. Now, I'm therefore accused of being the man who falls out of the skyscraper and he says, so far, so good, as he passes the second story. People say, yeah, but what about the future? And quite right, we need to concern ourselves with that. But the way to do it is to research the heck out of technologies that might help us produce energy without emissions, and to gently nudge the world towards lower carbon things. It's not to punish the poor. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking about the poor in this country.
Worldwide.
Africans are being denied coal-fired and gas-fired electricity because the Western aid agencies won't support those technologies. And as a result, the billion people on the planet who don't have access to electricity at all and therefore end up cooking over wood fires and inhaling smoke and dying of respiratory diseases and things, they are suffering because of these policies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm driven by compassion for real people here. Mm-hmm. And when people say, yeah, but what about my grandchildren? I say, well, you're rich. Your grandchildren are probably going to be okay. I'm worried about poor people today, poor kids today.
Yeah.
There you go. You've got me fired up.
Good, good. No, well, I wonder if, to summarise, we can discuss... Let's say that we make Matt Ridley Secretary of State for the Environment.
Dream on.
Ah, and you are tasked with charging ahead with the government's plans for decarbonisation. What do you do?
Well, it's going to be very difficult to unravel when I get this new job, which you've kindly offered me, mm-hmm. get my feet under the table. I will be confronted with civil servants telling me, yes, but we have committed to these expenditures to the renewable energies. You can't cancel them overnight. You can't do this, you can't do that. So it won't be easy to get from here to there. But I would do everything I could to slam on the brakes on this sluicing of money from poor people to rich people. That is what the renewable and other industries does. And I would try to ignore the howls of pain from very wealthy investors mm-hmm. Who were complaining about the fact that they were looking for a good return on a wind farm off somewhere in the middle of the North Sea that was going to produce electricity on a windy day, but not on the two-thirds of the days when the wind doesn't really blow very much. You'd have to slam on the brakes on what's been happening already. As I say, you would try and gradually replace a bad tax, like a jobs tax, with a good tax that discourages the production of carbon dioxide. I would try and free up the market to find the right solutions here.
Yeah.
Now, the nuclear industry would come crawling to me saying, you say you like nuclear, but I'm sorry, we can't live without subsidies. And I would say the reason you can't live without subsidies is because we've driven up your costs through the roof over the years by actually going too far in terms of safety concerns. And I would say, yeah, there's a point there. We need to find a way to get competition working again. Because the trouble with a nuclear power plant, we build them like Egyptian pyramids, one at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of mass producing them and therefore learning by doing and getting much cheaper at mm-hmm. making them. So we would try and start a program of small modular nuclear reactors that would get that going. But otherwise, I'd let the market go for gas, because that's what it wants to do. That's where the cheapest electricity is going to come from. And we'd have several decades of really good, reliable, relatively low carbon gas-fired electricity, followed by presumably a transition to new nuclear technologies. Because the other thing I'd do is I would make sure that money is incentivized to go into generalized research on what new technologies, nuclear fission, nuclear fusion, all these technologies that could provide us with carbon-free electricity at a reasonable price and reliably in the second half of the 20th century, which is when the problem's going to arise.
Well, I think we can both agree that government regulation, potentially motivated by good intentions, especially in the mission to decarbonise, illustrates the point very well that state intervention's not always the best route to getting the best results, is it?
I'm afraid that is the problem, that the state has walked into a fairly efficient, relatively cheap system and made it worse. Mm-hmm. We've talked mainly about electricity, but I could talk about electric cars and biofuels for transport as well, and other things.
Matt Ridley, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Darren, for having me.